immediately clocked him as a con. The beady eyes, the beaten down, angry slope of his shoulders. If he wasn't hiding something, then she was in the wrong business. He pointed to the articles again.
You need to read these. You'll understand.
She read off some of the headlines from the first stack of clippings. Teenager's body found in woods. Student declared missing. Mother pleads with police to search for missing daughter. She thumbed through the other stacks. More of the same. All in reverse order, so they started with a body being found and ended up with a woman who hadn't shown up for work, class, or family dinner. Someone else had collected these stories for Nesbitt. There were no newspapers in prison. The articles must have been mailed to him. And since they were actual newsprint articles, she assumed a mother or elderly relative had done the honors. Faith checked the dates above the bylines. The Grant County clippings were from 8 years ago. The others span the years in between. These stories aren't exactly current.
My research is limited by my circumstances.
Nesbitt indicated the two more recent cases.
This one, she went missing 3 months ago. Her body was found last month. This one was found yesterday morning. Yesterday morning!
His voice had screeched up on the last sentence. Faith let a few seconds pass before she answered, making it clear that yelling would not be tolerated. How'd you hear about a body being found when you've been in lockdown since the riot? Nesbitt's lips smacked open, then quickly shut. He must have had access to a smartphone.
The woman's name is Alexandra McAllister. Her body was found by two hikers.
Faith wanted to check on Will. She looked over her shoulder, telling him the name of the city where the body had been found.
Sotinacoochee.
He nodded, but his attention was zeroed in on Nesbitt's face. Will was good at spotting liars. Judging by his expression, he wasn't looking at one. Faith scanned the 8-day-old article on Alexandra McAllister's initial disappearance. The woman had gone for a hike and hadn't returned. The search had been called because of inclement weather. Sauti was in White County, which meant the sheriff's department was handling the investigation. Faith had watched a news story about the woman's body being found in the woods. The reporter had said foul play was not suspected. She asked Nesbitt,
"Who sent you these?" "A friend, but that doesn't matter. I have valuable information to trade."
Nesbitt clasped his hands together. His nails were rimmed with black, like mold around a shower tile.
"I know who killed Jesus Vasquez."
"We'll probably know who killed him by the end of the day," Faith bluffed,
"but not by much." She was pretty sure from scanning the jackets on the 18 inmates that they were close to nailing their guys.
Get-out-of-jail-free cards are very expensive.
"I can save you the time. All I'm asking for is a fair shake."
He was holding back something, obviously. Cons held back the happy when they called their mother on her birthday.
"Look into these."
Nesbitt indicated the articles again.
"You could be the cop who arrests the serial killer. All of these women got snatched after I was convicted. That's the guy you want. Not me. I'm innocent."
"That sets you apart from every other inmate inside these walls."
"You're not listening to me, damn it!"
Nesbitt's voice was loud enough to echo in the cramped room. He gritted his teeth, biting back an explosion of words. He had been institutionalized long enough to learn that anger would not get him what he wanted. But he had also been institutionalized, which meant self-control was probably not one of his strengths. He said,
"Look, I don't belong in this facility. I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Local law enforcement jammed me up because a young white college student was killed and they had to pin it on somebody. It was blatant profiling.
Faith said, statistically, white women are more likely to be murdered by white men.
That's not the kind of profiling I'm talking about.
Nesbitt's temper finally broke through.
Why aren't you listening to me, you stupid fucking bitch?
Faith felt Will coil behind her like a rattlesnake. Nick had pushed away from the wall. Nesbitt was surrounded, but his hands were still clenched. His ass was barely in the seat. Faith thought of all the places he could punch her before Will and Nick stopped him. Then she banished those thoughts, because she had a job to do. She'd told Will that inmates were like toddlers. If there was anything Faith knew, it was how to handle a bratty kid.
Time out.
Faith teed her hands to call it.
Nesbitt, if we're going to keep talking, you're going to have to do something for me.
Nesbitt continued to stew in his chair, but he was listening. Faith said,
take in a deep breath, then slowly let it go.
He looked confused, which was the point.
5 times. I do it with you.
Faith sucked in a deep breath to get him started.
In and out.
Nesbitt finally relented, his chest rising and falling once, then twice. Then eventually, the fury started to drain from his eyes. Faith shushed out the 5th breath, feeling her own heart rate start to slow.
Okay, lay out your case for me. Why did you bring this to Agent Shelton instead of the warden?
The warden's a limp dick piece of shit. I know the law. The GBI is in charge of investigating corrupt law enforcement officers.
Nesbitt had spat out the words, but now he visibly worked to force some calm into his tone.
I am a victim of police corruption. I was profiled because I'm poor, because I had a record, because I spent too much time with girls.
Girls. Faith asked, how old were these young ladies?
That's not the point, Christ!
Nesbitt's fist hovered over the table. He caught himself before banging it down. Unprompted, he took another deep breath, then hissed it out between his teeth. His breath was foul. She noticed that his skin was clammy. Faith glanced over Nesbitt's shoulder. Nick had put on his glasses so he could read about the Grant County side of things. 8 years felt like a lifetime. The newspaper clipping was so old that he was holding it with both hands so it wouldn't tear. She could tell from his face that every word he was reading was like a punch to the gut. Faith told Nesbitt,
like I said, we've got the Vasquez thing pretty much figured out. And if we choose to investigate these cases, you've already given us the articles, so we really don't.
Wait!
He reached for her hand, but stopped at the last minute.
Just wait, okay? I've got more.
Faith left her hand on the table, though her instinct had been to reel back. She looked at her watch.
You've got 1 minute.
Vasquez was killed for his distribution network.
Nesbitt licked his lips, anxious for a reaction.
I can tell you how they're bringing in the phones, where they're stashing them, how the money works. I won't testify, but I can put you exactly where they'll be when the phones come in.
Faith felt obliged to point out the obvious.
We can break the distribution network ourselves. We did it 4 years ago. Almost 50 corrections officers are behind bars right now because of it.
Do you have another year to launch an investigation?
Nesbitt asked.
Does the GBI want to waste all that time and money and resources and pull in the FBI and DEA and the sheriff's office and put agents undercover and work another sting that takes millions of dollars and ends up embarrassing your sorry asses with all those bad cops on trial every time you turn on the news?
The guy had done his homework. Money, federal agencies, Public humiliation? There wasn't one part of what he'd said that didn't shoot fear into the heart of every cop over the rank of sergeant.
"I can hand the phone racketeering to you on a silver platter," Nesbitt said. "I'll give you 1 week to look into these cases in the newspapers. 1 week instead of a year-long investigation. Plus you get to nail a serial killer. All you've got to do is stop the bullshit."
Without warning, Nick raked back Nesbitt's chair and slammed him into the wall. Faith was so shocked that she stood up, hand going to her belt, but her gun was in a lockbox by the metal detector.
"Agent Shelton," she boomed, using her cop voice, "back away from... you slimy kid fucker."
Nick grabbed Nesbitt's shirt and yanked him up to standing.
"You know you're not getting out of here. Your own article says your conviction was upheld twice. No one believed your bullshit. Not the jury, not the appellate court, not the state supreme court." "So what?"
Nesbitt screamed back.
"Sandra Bland is dead. John Hinckley's a free man. OJ's playing golf in Florida. You telling me our legal system is fair?"
Nick's face was so close that their noses were touching. His fist reared back.
"I'm telling you to watch your fucking mouth or I will beat you to the fucking ground."
Will's hand was on Nick's shoulder. Faith hadn't seen him move, but suddenly he was there. She saw his fingers flex, more like the pat that Nick had given him back in the interrogation room. Faith was running through all the ways this could go from bad to worse when the air changed in the room. Slowly, Nick turned. He looked at Will. His eyes were wild, and then they weren't. His muscles were tensed, but then they weren't. His fists unclenched. He took a step back.
"Jesus!"
Nesbitt hopped on one leg, trying to put some space between them. Will righted the chair. He helped Nesbitt sit back down. Faith silently begged Nick to leave, but he took his post behind the inmate, hands shoved deep into the front pockets of his jeans.
"Asshole!"
Nesbitt smoothed down his wrinkled shirt. He was visibly shaken. Faith felt the same. This wasn't how they did things. She had never seen Nick explode like that. She never wanted to see it again.
"Okay."
Faith could barely hear her own voice over the rapid tap of her own heartbeat. She had to get the interview back on track, not least of all because she didn't want to be called to testify by a prosecutor who was charging Nick with a custodial assault.
"Nesbitt, I'm listening to you. Tell me about your articles. What are we looking for?"
Nesbitt wiped his mouth with his hands.
"You gonna let him get away with that?"
"Get away with what?"
Faith shook her head in mock disbelief, making herself the shittiest kind of cop there was.
"I didn't see anything."
She didn't need to look back at Will to know that he was shaking his head, too.
"Nesbitt," she said, "this is your moment. Either start talking or we'll leave."
"I was set up."
Nesbitt wiped his mouth again.
"God's honest truth, I was framed."
"Okay."
Faith could feel a river of sweat flowing down her back. She had to make this man feel like he was being listened to.
"Who framed you? Tell me about it."
"It was those fucking small-town cops, okay? They controlled everything that happened in that county. The prosecutor, the judge, the jury, they all bought into that self-righteous cowboy bullshit."
He turned around, making sure that they all knew the kind of cowboy bullshit he was talking about.
"Careful, son."
Nick's voice sounded gravelly.
"You don't want to go letting something out that you can't put back in the bottle."
Nesbitt's anger had given way to despair.
"You stupid redneck motherfucker. What do you think I've got to lose?"
Faith waited for Nick to do something stupid again. But he just lifted his chin and stared out into the hallway. She studied Nesbitt's face. Dark circles pooled under his eyes. Deep lines creased his forehead. He looked like an old man. Being inside could age anyone, but being inside with a disability must have been a whole new circle of hell. In the silence, she drummed her fingers on the table. She asked Nesbitt,
"How do you know about Vasquez's phone business?"
"I've been doing janitorial in this place for 6 years. Nobody sees me, so I can see everybody else."
Nesbitt counted off on his fingers.
"I can give you names, places, suppliers, and dealers. You think the warden found all the phones in this place? A man can't take a shit in here without a cell signal squirting out."
Faith scanned the Grant County articles, confirming what Nick had said.
"You've already lost 2 appeals. You know judges don't like to admit other judges are wrong. How is an investigation going to benefit you?"
"It'll benefit everybody. These are dirty cops. They locked up the wrong man. They framed me and they let the real killer get away. The rot started in Grant County, but it spread across the state. And now these other women are dead because of it."
Nesbitt sat back with a smug look on his face. He could feel the tide shifting.
"We're in lockdown for another week. Like I said, I'll give you that long to look into it."
"We'd need a proffer," Faith said. "Something to prove that you can deliver what you're offering."
"I will tell you one stash location once I know you're seriously investigating these cases."
"Define that," Faith said. "What does seriously investigating mean?"
The smug look got even smugger.
"I'll know."
Faith's fingers were still drumming the table as she tried to see through to the end of this game.
"Hypothetically, let's say we uncover proof that law enforcement acted inappropriately. That's no guarantee that you're going to get out of here."
Nesbitt confirmed one of her suspicions.
"Second best thing to me getting out of this hell hole would be those crooked bastards ending up in here."
"I hate to tell you this," Faith said, "but Jeffrey Tolliver died 5 years ago.
"You think I don't know that? The whole fucking county went into mourning. There's a damn plaque in the middle of Main Street like he was some kind of hero. But I'm telling you, he was poison."
Nesbitt was getting agitated again, this time with righteous indignation.
"Tolliver was the ringleader. He taught that entire force how to break the law and get away with it, and they're still out there doing it. I want that fucking plaque torn down. I want to shit on his name, then set it on fire."
Faith had to wrap this up before Nick went off again. She told Nesbitt,
"No matter how solid your information is, the state is not going to spend resources on a vendetta. We investigate crimes. We make cases. We can't retroactively charge dead people."
"This dirty fucker will snitch on Tolliver the minute you show her the cuffs."
Nesbitt jabbed his finger into one of the Grant County articles. Detective takes the stand. Nesbitt said,
"She's still a cop. Still out there pulling the dirty shit Tolliver taught her. Destroying everything she touches. It's your job to take down bad cops. You take her down, I guarantee she'll drag Tolliver and everybody else down with her."
Even without the articles, the "she" narrowed it down to the point of a pin. Grant County had only ever had one female detective in its entire history. Lena Adams had been recruited straight out of the academy. All of her early promise had dissolved into a cesspit of lazy shortcuts and dirty tricks. Faith knew this because Lena had been investigated by the GBI before. Will had been the agent in charge. When Sarah had found out, she'd almost left him. And for good reason. Nesbitt wasn't wrong about Lena Adams destroying everything she touched. She was the reason that Jeffrey Tolliver had been murdered. Faith leaned her head into her hand as she read through Daryl Eric Nesbitt's jacket. The file was as thick as a Bible, most of it filled with treatment notes relating to his amputation. Faith's eyes blurred over the impenetrable medical jargon. Her back was aching. She was balancing more than sitting in what passed for a pew inside the prison chapel. She glanced up to check on Will. He was doing as usual, leaning against a wall, listening but not listening. Nick was giving Amanda the rundown of what Nesbitt had told them in the cramped office and why he had waited until now to tell her about it. Faith wondered if he was going to get to the part where he'd laid hands on an inmate, but Nick seemed mostly focused on Nesbitt's smug demeanor. Later tonight, when Faith was trying to sleep, she would go through every single second of the interview and excoriate herself for protecting Nick. It had been instinctual, visceral, like vomiting when you had food poisoning. And the worst part was that she knew she would do the same thing the next time. Faith blinked to clear her eyes. She ignored the low rumble of one of Amanda's pointed questions. She looked around the room, which was set up for all denominations. With every shade of Jesus as well as a metal colander, she assumed was for Pastafarians, a religion that, after several lawsuits, was legally recognized by the state. Graffiti was scratched into the pulpit. Colored stickers lent a stained glass effect to the one sliver of a window. The damp little room was depressing enough to turn the Pope into an atheist.
"Ma'am?"
Nick was clearly trying to hold it together.
"Tolliver was as solid as they come. You know that. He was one of the best cops, the best men in the damn state. I put my life in his hands more than once. I'd gladly do it again if he was still with us. Hell, I'd trade places with him right now."
Faith checked on Will again. It was hard enough to compete with a ghost. Hearing Jeffrey put up there with the saints must have been excruciating. Amanda asked,
"There's no way to extricate one from the other? Throw Adams under the bus? Keep Tolliver out of it?"
Nick shook his head. So did Faith. Daryl Nesbitt seemed determined to drag Jeffrey's name through the mud right alongside Lena's, which was a particular talent of the heinous bitch. She always managed to taint everyone around her.
"All right."
Amanda gave a curt nod.
"Nesbitt is offering two things. One, the names of Vasquez's killers. Two, information on the influx of cell phones into this facility. In exchange, Nesbitt has put a one-week clock on us, opening the cases of the dead women from the articles and investigating Grant County. Yes?"
"Yes,"
Nick said. Faith nodded. Will kept holding up the wall. Amanda said,
"Let's start with the Vasquez murder. Two suspects, Maduro and who else?"
"My money's on Michael Padilla," Nick said. "He's a bone breaker with a side of psychosis. Got transferred here from Gwinnett DOC after biting off another inmate's finger."
Faith recognized the name from the stack of jackets she'd read through. "It's not a stretch to think a finger biter would be a hand chopper." Amanda said,
"Nick, see if you can get Maduro to turn on Padilla. If we can unwind the Vasquez murder, we can cut Nesbitt off at the knees."
Faith felt a jolt of shock. Amanda didn't know about Nesbitt's prosthesis, and Faith could not think of a natural way to bring it up. Amanda called to Nick.
"None of this gets back to Sarah, understood?"
"Yes, ma'am."
Nick had a grim set to his mouth. On his way out of the chapel, he patted Will on the shoulder. Faith didn't know if Nick was offering Will support, thanking him for intervening with Nesbitt, or tapping him in. The least she could do was make sure she said Jeffrey Tolliver's name as little as possible. Amanda said,
"Faith, nutshell it for me."
"Okay, this is where it gets tricky. Grant County never charged Nesbitt with murder.
Amanda raised an eyebrow.
Nope.
The investigation is still technically open and considered unsolved. There was a ton of circumstantial evidence that led them to presume that Nesbitt was the killer. The biggest mark against him was that the bad things stopped happening when Nesbitt was locked up.
The Wayne Williams paradigm.
Correct. Nesbitt was arrested and convicted for other unrelated crimes that were uncovered during the murder investigation, but it's presumed he committed the underlying crimes.
Faith added, if I had to use a bad cliche, I'd say Nesbitt is playing chess instead of checkers.
He thinks if we can clear him of the murder, that opens up the possibility of his next move, which would be knocking down the other charges.
The other charges being?
Initially, Grant County caught him with a shit ton of kiddie porn on his laptop computer. We're talking tweens, 8 to 11 years old.
Faith pushed away thoughts of her own children.
Nesbitt was sentenced to 5 years with possible probation after 3, but it never came to that. The idiot is king of the self-inflicted wound. He started making trouble the minute he walked through the gates. Lots of fighting, holding on to contraband, stealing shit from the wrong people. Finally, he ended up punching out a CO who woke up out of a coma 2 weeks later. Nesbitt got 2 dimes tacked onto his initial sentence for attempted murder of a corrections officer.
He's looking at Buck Rogers time,
Amanda said, using old-timey slang for a release date so far into the future that it felt like a fantasy.
Nesbitt doesn't have a lot to lose. He has a history of creating trouble.
What's your impression?
Does he really think he's going to walk out of here?
He's a below-the-knee amputee.
Does that change your answer?
No.
Faith tried to put herself in Nesbitt's shoe.
He's behind bars for the attack on the CO, no matter what happens to his original case. There's no causal connection between the alleged constitutional violation and the axe he took against the guard. But here's where the chess moves come in. Take away the cloud hanging over Nesbitt's head concerning the Grant County investigation. If Nesbitt can get the kiddie porn charge off his sheet, he's out of protective custody. Then he can petition for transfer. Yes, he's got the attempted murder on the CO, but I can see a scenario where he argues diminished capacity because of the disability. That could buy him a ticket into a low-security facility, which is a country club compared to where he is now.
You think he's playing us for better accommodations?
I think he's absolutely playing us. Con's got a con. Nesbitt wouldn't do this if he wasn't working at least 20 different angles. My gut tells me that vengeance against Grant County is his primary motive, but there's a lot of other benefits he can get if we reopen his original case. Attention, special treatment, trips to the police station, the courthouse.
Amanda asked,
Will, anything to add?
Will said,
Nope.
Amanda told Faith,
Tell me about Nesbitt's petitions for post-trial relief.
He appealed his kiddie porn conviction on 2 separate issues.
Faith referred to her notes to make sure she got it right.
First, he said the initial search of his house that revealed the contents of his hard drive was fruit of the poison tree. Law enforcement did not have a warrant, and they did not have probable cause to enter his residence. Nothing pointed to him as a suspect.
Second,
even if law enforcement had probable cause to enter, they were limited to searching for a suspect or a weapon or a possible hostage, not a computer file. They would have needed a warrant to search the computer.
Amanda's eyebrow rose up again, because Nesbitt's lawyers were on firmer ground.
And?
Faith's cheeks felt red. Will had started to pay close attention. He had a weird sixth sense about when shit was about to get real.
One of the detectives testified at trial that she was searching the desk drawers for weapons when she accidentally bumped the laptop. The screen woke up, She saw images of child pornography, and they charged Nesbitt for possession of illegal images.
Lena Adams.
Amanda's disgusted tone said it all. None of them bought the story. This was why Nick had been so hot under the collar when they were interviewing Nesbitt. For Faith's part, she wouldn't believe Lena Adams if the crooked cop swore on a stack of Bibles that the sun rose in the east. Faith felt overwhelmed by the need to state the obvious.
If we discovered during an investigation that Lena lied about how the porn was found on Nesbitt's computer, then every single case she's ever worked on will be put under the microscope. And Nesbitt can make a damn good argument to kick that porn charge off his sheet. We would basically be helping a pedophile.
You just said he'd remain in prison.
But it would be a nicer prison.
We'll burn that bridge when we cross it.
Amanda paced off the space between the pulpit and the wall, her hands clasped together under her chin.
Tell me about the newspaper articles.
Faith wanted to stew on Nesbitt some more, but Amanda was right. She said,
all of the articles appear to be from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, except for the Grant County ones, which are from the Grant Observer. When I asked Nesbitt how he got the articles, he said a friend sent them.
Mother? Father?
According to his jacket, Nesbitt's mother died from an overdose when he was a kid. His stepfather raised him, but that guy's been serving time in the Atlanta pen for almost a decade. They don't write or talk on the phone. Nesbitt's got no other family. He hasn't had a visitor since he entered the system. He doesn't make phone calls or send emails. Unless he's using a contraband phone, then all bets are off.
I'll put in a request for Nesbitt's mail. There's a central station where all inmate correspondences are scanned and cross-checked for suspected criminal activity.
Amanda typed the order into her phone, asking Faith,
what's the importance of Nesbitt's one-week deadline? What happens in a week?
The prison is taken off lockdown. Maybe his phone smuggling information won't be relevant when the inmates are out of their cells. Maybe they'll kick his ass if they find out he's been talking to the popo.
She shrugged.
Maybe he's been inside long enough to know that inertia is the enemy of progress.
Maybe.
She dropped her phone back into her pocket.
Should I be worried about Nick?
Faith's stomach clenched.
Everybody needs worrying about sometime.
Thank you, Agent Fortune Cookie.
She rolled her hand at the wrist to move along the conversation.
Return to the articles.
8 possible victims total, and obviously that's not including Grant County.
Faith looked back at her notes.
They were all Caucasian females between 19 and 41 years old. They were students, office workers, an EMT, a kindergarten teacher, and a vet tech. Married, divorced, single. The articles start with Grant County. The other cases spanned the subsequent 8 years and took place in Pickens, Effingham, Appling, Taliaferro, Dougal, and if he's right about the woman found yesterday, White County.
So, someone took a dartboard to the state.
Amanda turned and paced back to the pulpit.
M.O.
All the women were reported missing by friends or family. They were found anywhere from 8 days to 3 months later, usually in a wooded area. Not hidden, just laid on the ground. Some were on their backs. Some were face down on their sides. A lot were ravaged by local wildlife, especially the ones up north. All of the victims were dressed in their own clothes.
Raped?
The articles don't say, but if we're talking murder, we're more than likely talking about rape.
Cause of death.
Faith didn't have to look at her notes, because the deaths had all been classified the same way.
None of the coroner saw anything untoward. So we've got unknown, no suspected foul play, unknown, undetermined, wash, rinse, repeat.
Amanda frowned, but she was clearly unsurprised. At the county level, Only coroners had the power to officially rule a death suspicious and request an autopsy by professional medical examiner. They were all elected officials, and a medical license was not required to do the job. Only one county coroner in Georgia was a physician. The rest were, among other things, funeral directors, teachers, a hairdresser, the proprietor of a car wash, a heating and air technician, a motorboat mechanic, and the owner of a shooting range. Faith said, "There's speculation in some of the newspaper articles about murder, but nothing concrete. Maybe the local cops disagreed with the coroner, and leaking to the press was their way of juicing an investigation. I would need to go to the individual counties to request the case files. Then we'd need to interview the investigators and witnesses to find out if there were any suspects. That's 8 different local law enforcement agencies to negotiate with." Faith left unsaid the resultant shit show. The GBI was a state agency, the same way the FBI was at the federal level. With limited exceptions, they had no jurisdiction over local cases, even murder. They could not just waltz in and take over an investigation. They had to be asked by the local sheriff, the local prosecutor, or ordered in by the governor. "I can query some sources on an informal basis," Amanda said. "Tell me about the victims. Blonde, plain, pretty, short, fat. Did they sing in the choir, play the flute?" She was looking for a detail that connected the women. Faith said, "All I can go by is the photos that accompanied the articles. Some blonde, some brunette. Some of them wore glasses, some didn't. One had braces. Some kept their hair short, some wore it long." "So," Amanda summarized, "taking out Grant County, we have 8 different women of different ages who were working in different fields, looked nothing alike, and were all found dead showing no discernible cause of death, located in different areas of a state where thousands of missing women cases remain open, in a country where roughly 300,000 women and girls are reported missing every single year."
"The woods,"
Will said. Amanda and Faith turned to look at him. He said,
"That's what connects them. Their bodies were left in wooded areas."
Amanda said,
2/3 of the state is covered in forests. It would be difficult not to leave a body in the woods. The phone rings off the hook during hunting season."
"We need to know how they died,"
Will said.
"They weren't violently, visibly murdered, and their bodies weren't put on display the way you would expect with a serial killer. Murdering them was secondary to rape."
Faith tried to put his theory in plain English.
"You're saying he's not a serial killer. He's a serial rapist who kills his victims because they could identify him?"
Amanda intervened.
"Let's not use the word serial so casually here. Daryl Nesbitt is a convicted pedophile who seems to be playing us like a fiddle. The only cereal at this point is what you had for breakfast."
Faith looked down at her notes. She knew Amanda was right. But she'd also been a cop long enough to trust her instincts. Faith imagined if she could strip Amanda down into parts, she'd feel the same kind of tingling that was shaking Faith's own bones right now. Will asked,
"You know all of those backlogged rape kits that are finally being tested?"
"Of course," Amanda said. "We've made dozens of arrests off the results."
"Sarah told me about this paper in one of her journals,"
Will explained.
"Some graduate students looked at the offender methodology from the solved cases. We're talking all over the country. What they found is that, with some exceptions, the majority of serial rapists aren't stuck on one way of doing things. Sometimes the guy is violent, and sometimes he's not. Sometimes he takes the woman to a second location, and sometimes he doesn't. The same guy might use a knife at one time, or a gun the other, or he might tie up one victim with a rope and use zip ties on the next one. Basically, a serial rapist's MO is rape."
Faith felt a crushing sense of futility. Every single law enforcement class taught them to investigate by M.O. Amanda simply asked,
"And? If all the cases from Nesbitt's articles are linked, trying to connect the victims through their jobs or their hobbies isn't going to lead us to the killer."
"We should pull rape reports from the areas."
Faith thought he was onto something. There could be other victims out there that he raped but didn't kill. Maybe they didn't see his face. Maybe he decided to let them go.
"Do you want to cull thousands of rape reports from the last 8 years? Amanda asked. "How about the women who were raped but didn't file reports? Should we start knocking on doors?"
Faith sighed through the acrimony. Will said,
"We need to find out how the victims died. He killed them without leaving a visible cause of death. That's not always easy. Bone shows bullet and knife blade marks. Strangulation almost always results in a broken hyoid. A tox screen would show poisoning. How's he killing them?"
Faith still liked his theory.
"If he's a rapist who murders instead of a murderer who..."
"The academic paper you're relying on is just that, one academic paper."
Amanda waved them off the subject.
"Let's return to Nesbitt. What made him focus on these articles in particular?"
"Is Nesbitt the one who focused on them?" Faith asked.
"He's working with someone on the outside. We need to know who his friend is and what criteria the friend used to select these particular articles."
Will suggested,
"The friend could be the murderer, or a copycat."
"Or a nut job, or an acolyte," Faith said. "Nesbitt told us he'd know if we were seriously investigating. He'd need a person on the outside to do that. So, a private detective, a corrections officer. God help his law enforcement."
"Let's not drive over that cliff just yet,"
Amanda cautioned.
"Nesbitt's playing omniscient, but the way he would know we're investigating is the same way the world would know about it. The news reporters would be all over a possible multiple murder case. Not just local, but national. That kind of scrutiny is exactly what I want to avoid. Everything from here on out stays between us. We need to fly so low under the radar that a snake can't sense what we're up to."
Faith couldn't disagree, but only because her inclination was to deprive Darryl Nesbitt of anything he wanted.
"It's subjective anyway. What's a serious investigation? Who gets to decide the definition? A convicted child predator? I don't think so."
Amanda said,
"For the moment, we deal with what's in front of us. Nick will work the Vasquez murder. I'll track down Darryl Nesbitt's friend on the outside. You two need to get Lena's version of the Grant County investigation. She would have still been in uniform then. I imagine she noted every degree in the weather." "Step lightly. Even a broken clock is right twice a day. We may end up needing her. We'll regroup this afternoon and go from there."
"Hold on."
What Will said next seemed to surprise Amanda as much as Faith.
"Sarah has a right to know what's happening."
"What's happening?" Amanda asked. "We have a pedophile making wild accusations. We have some newspaper stories that show absolutely no pattern. I'm not sure this isn't all some inmate's idea of a wild goose chase. Are you?"
Will said,
"Sarah was a medical examiner for Grant County. She could remember."
"How do you think Sarah's going to respond to the accusation that Jeffrey Tolliver ran a crooked shop? Look at what it did to Nick. In 20 years, I've never seen him so rattled. Do you think Sarah's going to take it any easier? Especially since Lena Adams is involved?"
Amanda went in for the kill.
"That went so well for you the last time, didn't it?"
Will said nothing. But they all knew that Sarah had been furious the last time Will had let himself get sucked into Lena's bullshit. Not without reason. Lena had a habit of getting the people closest to her killed.
We need information, Wilbur. We are investigators. Let's investigate.
Amanda's tone indicated that was the end of the discussion. Lena Adams is still in Macon. I want you both to drive down there right now and squeeze the truth out of her. I want her copies of case files, autopsy reports, notebooks, cocktail napkins, anything she has.
As I said, play nicely. But remember that Adams is the one who threw this steaming pile of horse manure in our labs. If this goes south, we're going to throw it right back into her face.
Faith was ready to follow her out of the chapel, but Will had taken on the physical attributes of a block of cement. Amanda told him,
"If you agree to keep Sarah out of it for the moment, I'll get the White County coroner to bring her onto the most recent case."
Will rubbed his jaw.
"Not 5 minutes ago, you said that the way we find the perpetrator is by the way he kills. If Sarah autopsied the first victim, then she might recognize the killer's signature on the most recent one."
"She's a grown woman, not a divining rod."
"And you both work for me. My case, my rules."
Amanda took her phone out of her pocket. She ended the discussion by showing him the top of her head. She was still typing as she left the chapel. Will sat down on the pew. The wood creaked. He said,
90% of all the arguments I ever had with Sarah had been about me not telling her things."
That seemed like a low ratio, but Faith didn't quibble.
"Look, I wouldn't know how to be in a healthy relationship if Squidward painted me a picture, but this is one of those rare instances where I agree with Amanda. What exactly are you keeping from Sarah? All we've got right now is a whole bunch of what the fuck."
He started rubbing his jaw again.
"You're saying wait a few hours, see what we can dig up. But either way, tell her the truth tonight."
The tonight part was new, but Faith asked him,
"Do you really want Sarah to spend the next 6 hours worrying about something that might not ever become a thing?"
Slowly, finally, Will started to nod. Faith looked at her watch.
"It's almost noon. We'll get lunch on the way to Macon."
He nodded again, but asked,
"What if this becomes a thing?"
Faith didn't have an answer. Obviously, the worst part would be realizing that a serial killer had been operating for years without their knowledge. The second worst part was more personal. A wrongful conviction was the kind of scandal that had onions inside of onions. The media would peel back every layer. The corruption, the trial, the investigations, the hearings, the lawsuits, the condemnations, the inevitable podcasts and documentaries. Will summed it up.
"Sarah's gonna watch her husband get murdered all over again."
Grant County, Tuesday. Chapter 3. Jeffrey Tolliver took a left outside the college and drove up Main Street. He rolled down the window for some fresh air. Cold wind whistled through the car. The staticky patter of the police scanner offered a low undertone. He squinted at the early morning sun. Pete Wayne, the man who owned the diner, tipped his hat as Jeffrey drove by. Spring was early this year. The dogwoods were already weaving a white curtain across the sidewalks. The women from the garden club had planted flowers in the planters along the road. There was a gazebo display outside the hardware store. A rack of clothes marked clearance was in front of the dress shop. Even the dark clouds in the distance couldn't stop the street from looking picture perfect. Grant County had not taken its name from Ulysses S., the northern general who had accepted Lee's surrender at Appomattox, but from Lemuel Pratt Grant, the man who in the late 1800s had extended the railroad from Atlanta through South Georgia and to the sea. The new lines had put cities like Hartsdale, Avondale, and Madison on the map. The flat fields and rich soil had yielded some of the best corn, cotton, and peanuts in the state. Businesses had sprung up to service the booming middle class. With every boom, there was a bust, and the first bust came with the Great Depression. The only way the three cities could survive was to band together. They had combined sanitation, fire services, and the police department in order to save money. Economizing had kept them above water until another boom had arrived by way of an army base being erected in Madison. Then came another boom, when Avondale was designated a maintenance hub for the Atlanta-Savannah rail line. A few years later, Hartsdale had managed to persuade the state to fund a community college at the end of Main Street. All of this booming had happened well before Jeffrey's time, but he was familiar with the political forces that had led to the current bust. He had watched it happen in his own small hometown, over in Alabama. The BRAC Commission had closed the army base. Reaganomics trickled down into the railroad industry, and the maintenance hub had dried up. Then there were trade deals and seemingly endless wars. Then the world economy didn't just tank. It had bypassed the toilet and gone straight into the sewer. Except for the college, which had evolved into a technological university specializing in agribusiness, Hartsdale would have followed the same downward trend as every other rural American town. You could call it either careful planning or dumb luck, but Grant Tech was the lifeblood of the county. The students kept the local businesses alive. The local businesses tolerated the students so long as they paid their bills. As chief of police, Jeffrey's first directive from the mayor was to keep the school happy if he wanted to keep his job. He doubted very much the school was going to be happy today. A body had been found in the woods. The girl was young, probably a student, and certainly dead. The officer on scene had told Jeffrey that it looked like an accident. The girl was dressed in running gear. She was lying flat on her back. She had likely stumbled on a tree root and smashed the back of her head against a rock. This wasn't the first time a student had died under Jeffrey's tenure. Over 3,000 kids were enrolled at the university. By virtue of statistics, a small number of them would die every year. Some by meningitis or pneumonia, some by suicide or overdose, some, mostly young men, by stupidity. An accidental death in the woods was tragic, without doubt. But something about this particular death wasn't sitting right with Jeffrey. He'd been running in that very same forest. He'd even tripped on a tree root more times than he cared to admit. That kind of fall could lead to several different injuries. A wrist fracture if you managed to catch yourself. A broken nose if you didn't. You might hit your temple or bust up your shoulder if you fell sideways. There were a lot of ways to hurt yourself, but it was very unlikely you would flip around mid-fall and land flat on your back. He took a sharp turn onto Frying Pan Road, the main artery into a neighborhood colloquially referred to as IHOP, because all of the streets were named after items you would find at an international house of pancakes. Pancake Place, Belgian Waffle Way, Hash Brown Way. Jeffrey saw the rolling lights of a police cruiser splashing the southwest corner of Omelette Road. He parked his town car at an angle across the street. Spectators stood on their front lawns. The sun was still low in the sky. Some were dressed for work. Some were wearing soiled uniforms from the night shift. He told Brad Stevens, one of his junior officers,
"Roll out the tape to keep these people back."
"Yes, sir."
Brad excitedly fumbled with his keys to open the trunk. The kid was so new to the job that his mother still ironed his uniforms. He'd spent the last 3 months writing tickets and cleaning up after traffic accidents. This was Brad's first case involving a fatality. Jeffrey took in the scene as he made his way up the street. Older cars and trucks lined the road. IHOP was a working-class neighborhood, but to be frank, it was nicer than the one Jeffrey had grown up in. There were only a few boarded-up windows. The majority of the lawns were tidy. Light bulbs still glowed in the floodlights. The paint was peeling, but the curtains were clean, and everyone had dutifully lined up their trash cans on the curb for pickup. Jeffrey opened the lid on the closest can. The bin was empty. He spotted his team standing in a wide open field that ran behind the houses. The forest was just beyond the rise, at least 100 yards away. Jeffrey stepped out of the street. There wasn't a sidewalk. He walked through a vacant lot, carefully scanning the ground as he followed a worn path through the grass. Cigarette butts, beer bottles, wadded up pieces of aluminum foil. Jeffrey leaned down for a better look. He caught a whiff of cat urine.
Chief?
Lena Adams jogged to meet him. The young officer's blue uniform jacket was so big that it rode up under her chin. Jeffrey made a mental note to look into women's sizes the next time he ordered uniforms. Lena wasn't going to complain, but he was embarrassed by the oversight. He asked,
"You were the respondent officer?"
"Yes, sir."
She started to read from her notebook.
"The 911 call came in from a cell phone at 5:58 a.m. I was dispatched at that time and arrived at this location at 6:02. The caller met me in the middle of the field at 6:03. Officer Brad Stevens arrived to assist at 6:04. Truong then took us to the location. I verified the victim was deceased at 6:08. I assessed the position of the body and noted a large blood-covered rock by the victim's head. I called Detective Wallace at 6:09. We then taped off the area around the body and awaited Frank's arrival at 6:22.
Frank had called Jeffrey en route. He already knew the details, but he nodded for Lena to continue. The only way you learned how to do something was to do something.
Lena read, "Victim is a white female between the ages of 18 and 25, dressed in red running shorts and a navy blue t-shirt with a Grant Tech logo. She was found by another student, Leslie Truong, age 22. Truong walks this path 4 to 5 times a week. She goes to the lake to do Tai Chi. Truong didn't know the victim, but she was pretty upset all the same. I offered to radio a car to drive her to the campus nurse. She said she wanted to walk it off, take some time to think. She struck me as the woo-woo type."
Jeffrey's jaw had tightened.
"You let her walk back to campus on her own?"
"Yes, Chief. She was going to see the nurse. I made a promise she'd..."
"That's at least a 20-minute hike, Lena. All by herself?"
"She said she wanted..."
"Stop."
Jeffrey worked to maintain an even tone. Most of policing was learning through mistakes.
"Don't do that again. We turn over witnesses to family or friends. We don't send them on a 2-mile hike."
"But she..."
Jeffrey shook his head, but now wasn't the time to lecture Lena about compassion.
"I want to talk to Truong before the day is out. Even if she didn't know the victim, what she saw was traumatic. She needs to know that someone is in charge and looking out for people."
Lena gave a perfunctory nod. Jeffrey gave up.
"When you got here, the victim was lying on her back?"
"Yes, sir."
Lena thumbed to the back of her notebook. She had made a crude drawing of the body in relation to a stand of trees.
"The rock was to the right of her head. Her chin was turned slightly to the left. The ground was undisturbed. She didn't turn over. She landed on her back and hit her head."
"We'll let the coroner make that determination."
He pointed to the foil.
"Someone was smoking meth recently. Junkies are creatures of habit. I want you to pull all the incident reports for the last 3 months and see if we can match a name to the foil."
Lena had her pen out, but she wasn't writing. He said,
"It's garbage pickup day. Make sure we talk to the crew. I want to know if they saw anything suspicious."
Lena looked back toward the street, then at the forest.
"The victim tripped, Chief. Her head hit a giant rock. There's blood all over it. Why do we need witnesses?"
"Were you there when it happened? Is that exactly what you saw?"
Lena had no immediate answer. Jeffrey started walking across the field. Lena had to jog to keep up with him. She had been on the force for 3.5 years, but she was smart and most of the time she listened, so he went out of his way to teach her. He said,
I want you to remember this because it's important. This young woman has a family. She's got parents, siblings, friends. We're going to have to tell them that she's dead. They need to know we did a thorough job investigating the cause of her death. You treat every case as a homicide until you know it's not.
Lena's pen was finally moving. She was transcribing every word. He saw her underline homicide twice.
I'll check the incident reports and follow up on the garbage truck.
What's the victim's name?
She didn't have ID, but Matt's at the college asking around.
Good.
Of the detectives on the force, Matt Hogan was the most compassionate. There were some solid men on patrol, too. Jeffrey had gotten lucky with most of the legacy hires. Only a few were dead weight, and they would be gone by the end of the year. After 4 years of proving he could do this job, Jeffrey felt he had earned the benefit of tossing the bad apples.
Chief!
Frank stood in the middle of the field. He was 20 years Jeffrey's senior, with the physical presence of an asthmatic walrus. Frank had passed on the job of chief when the position had opened. He wasn't one for politics, and he knew his limitations. Jeffrey was certain the detective had his back, so long as it related to the job. He wasn't so sure about the other areas of his life.
Brock!
Frank coughed around the cigarette in his mouth.
Brock just got here. He's on his way to the body. She's that away. About 200 feet over the hill.
Dan Brock was the county coroner. His full-time job was at the funeral home. Jeffrey had found him to be competent, but Brock's father had dropped dead of a heart attack 2 days ago. The senior Brock had been found at the bottom of the stairs, which hadn't surprised Jeffrey. The man was a closet drinker. He'd reeked of alcohol. Jeffrey asked,
Do you think Brock's up to this?
He's still torn up, poor fella. He was real close to his daddy.
For unknown reasons, Frank started grinning.
I think we'll be okay.
Jeffrey turned to see the reason behind Frank's glee. Sarah Linton was walking through the vacant lot. She was wearing dark sunglasses. Her auburn hair was pulled back into a ponytail. She was dressed in a white long-sleeve shirt and matching short skirt.
Oh, great, Lena mumbled. Tennis Barbie to the rescue.
Jeffrey gave Lena a look of warning. Around the time of his divorce, he'd made the mistake of complaining about Sarah in front of Lena. She had taken carte blanche on the insults since then. He told her,
Make sure Brock isn't lost in the woods. Tell him Sarah's here.
Lena reluctantly trotted off. Frank stubbed his cigarette out on his shoe as Sarah walked across the field. Jeffrey allowed himself the pleasure of watching her. Objectively, she was beautiful. Her legs were long and lean. She had a certain grace to her movements. She was the smartest woman he had ever met, in a long line of incredibly intelligent women. After their divorce, he had persuaded himself that she hated him. Only recently had he realized that what Sarah felt for him was worse than hate. She was deeply disappointed. On a good day, Jeffrey could admit that he was disappointed too. Frank said,
I could punch you in the nuts for the rest of my life, and it still wouldn't be punishment enough for what you did.
Thanks, buddy.
Jeffrey patted Frank's shoulder in a non-appreciative way. Sarah's family was as entrenched in the community as the university. Frank played cards with her father. His wife volunteered with Sarah's mother. Jeffrey could have decapitated the high school mascot and gotten less grief.
Good to see you, sweet pea.
Frank let Sarah kiss his cheek.
Did you just get back from Atlanta?
I decided to stay the night.
Hi. Sarah spun the last word like a volley into Jeffrey's face.
Mama told me about the body.
She thought Brock might need help. Jeffrey was mindful that Frank was not giving them any privacy. He was also mindful that it was Tuesday morning. Sarah would normally be getting ready for work right now.
It's a little early for tennis.
I played yesterday. This way? She didn't wait for an answer. She followed the trail into the forest. Frank walked shoulder to shoulder with Jeffrey.
Sarah's just drove down from Atlanta, but she's wearing the same clothes she was wearing yesterday. I wonder what that means.
Jeffrey tasted metal from the fillings in his teeth. Frank called to Sarah.
How's Parker doing? Did you go up in his plane again?
The metal turned to blood. Sarah hadn't answered, so Frank told Jeffrey.
Parker used to be a Navy fighter pilot. Real top gun type. He's a lawyer now. Drives a Maserati. Eddie told me all about him.
Jeffrey could imagine Sarah's father merrily relaying the information over a hand of cards, secure in the knowledge that Frank would do his part to poke Jeffrey with the details. Frank laughed again. Then he coughed because his lungs were full of tar. Jeffrey tried to put them all back on a serious footing. They were walking toward a dead young woman. He looked at his watch. He talked to Sarah's back.
The victim was found half an hour ago. Lena took the call.
Sarah didn't turn around, but her ponytail bobbed as she nodded her head. Jeffrey told himself that it was good to have her here. She'd held the job of coroner before Brock, and unlike the funeral director, she was a medical doctor. An expert opinion on the victim was exactly what this case called for. There was no one Jeffrey trusted more than Sarah. That the feeling was not mutual was a fact that had lately started to wear on him. At least a year had passed since she'd filed for divorce. Jeffrey had thought Sarah's anger would eventually burn itself out, but it had taken on the aspects of an eternal flame. Intellectually, he understood why she couldn't let it go. It was bad enough that he was a cheating asshole, but he had humiliated her in the process. Sarah had literally caught him with his pants down, in their bed, in their house, with another woman. Any normal wife would have been pissed off. It's what Sarah had done next that was terrifying. Jeffrey had screamed for her to wait, but Sarah didn't wait. He had wrapped a blanket around his waist as he'd chased her through the house. On her way out, she'd grabbed the baseball bat that he kept by the front door. Jeffrey was stumbling down the front porch when she swung back the Louisville Slugger. She was standing over his 1968 Ford Mustang. The sound that came out of his mouth was like a howl. But Sarah hadn't destroyed his car. She had tossed the bat to the ground. She had walked over to her Honda Accord. Instead of driving away, she reached through the open window, released the handbrake, pushed the gear into neutral, then let the car roll into the lake. Jeffrey was so shocked that he dropped the blanket. The very next day, Sarah had hired a divorce lawyer, bought a convertible BMW Z4, and tendered her resignation as county coroner. Clem Waters, the mayor, had called Jeffrey and read him the letter. One sentence long, no further explanation, but the entire town knew about the affair by then, and Clem had given Jeffrey an earful. Then Jeffrey had gotten another earful from Marla Sims, the police station secretary. Then Pete Wayne had given him a third earful when Jeffrey had dropped by the diner for lunch. Not to be outdone, Jeb McGuire, the town pharmacist, had barely spoken to him when he'd filled Jeffrey's blood pressure medication. Kathy Linton, Sarah's church-going, God-fearing, self-righteous saint of a mother, had flipped him off with both hands in the parking lot. By the time Jeffrey had settled into his dank room at the Kudzu Arms outside of Avondale, he was happy for the silence. Then he'd drunk a lot of scotch, watched a lot of mindless television, and slowly come to the realization that all of this was his own fault. The way he saw it, his failure wasn't so much the screwing around as the getting caught. Jeffrey had grown up in a small town. He should have realized that by cheating on Sarah, he was also blowing up his relationship with the entire county. Frank gave another rattled cough as they walked deeper into the forest. The tone was appropriately somber now. The air had turned cold. Shadows tossed back and forth across the ground. In the distance, Jeffrey saw the yellow police tape wrapped around the trees. Lena had cordoned off a wide circle around the body. Sarah's foot slipped on a rock. Jeffrey reached out, steadying her at the small of her back. He thought about how this would have played out a year ago. Sarah would have reached back and squeezed his hand, or smiled at him, or done anything other than what she did now, which was to make a point of pulling away. Frank coughed harder as they traversed the hill. They stopped at the yellow tape. The victim lay about 15 feet away. The girl was slim, maybe 5'6", 120 pounds. Eyes closed, lips slightly parted. Dark brown hair, dressed for running. The rock by her head was half buried in the ground, about the size of a football. Dark blood webbed across the surface. A trickle of blood had dribbled out of her right nostril. No visible marks on her wrists or ankles. No visible signs of bruising, but she had likely been dead for less than an hour. Bruises took a while to make themselves known. Jeffrey was about to ask Lena to verify again that she hadn't turned over the body, when he heard sobbing. He turned around. Dan Brock was slumped against a tree. His hands covered his face. His body shook with grief. Brock. Sarah rushed to him. She had taken off her sunglasses. Her eyes had dark circles underneath.
Top Gun better not get used to late nights.
I'm so sorry about your daddy. Brock wiped away his tears. He looked embarrassed, but only because Jeffrey and Frank were watching.
I don't know what's gotten into me. I'm so sorry.
Dan, please don't feel the need to apologize. I can't imagine what you're going through. Sarah pulled a tissue out from her sleeve. She'd always had a soft spot for Brock. The man's life had not been easy. He was very strange. He'd grown up in a funeral home. All through school, Sarah had been the only kid who would sit with him at the lunch table. Brock blew his nose. He gave Jeffrey a contrite look.
Sarah's right, Brock. It's normal to be upset at a time like this.
Jeffrey came from a family of drunks. He should be more sympathetic.
We'll take care of the scene. Go be with your mama.
Brock's Adam's apple bobbed as he tried to squeeze out some words. He settled on a nod before leaving.
Sheesh,
Lena breathed out. Jeffrey shut her up with a look. She was too young to understand what it meant to lose somebody. Unfortunately, sympathy had to be learned the hard way. Okay, let's get this over with before the rain comes. Sarah reached into the supply kit Brock had left. Specimen tubes, evidence bags, Nikon camera, Sony camcorder, lights. She pulled on a pair of exam gloves. The victim was found half an hour ago. Jeffrey raised up the yellow crime scene tape so Sarah could cross under. He relayed the information Frank had given him on the phone.
A student called it in. Leslie Truong. She was heading to the lake. She heard music playing from the victim's headphones.
Sarah noted the headphones, which were on the ground by the victim's head. They were corded to a pink iPod shuffle that was clipped to the hem of the girl's shirt. She asked Lena, "Did you turn off the music?" Lena tilted up her chin by way of a yes. Jeffrey wanted to shake her by the collar. Lena must have picked up on his disapproval because she said, "I didn't want the battery to run down in case there was something important on it." Sarah's eyes found Jeffrey's with a big fat, "Seriously?" She had never liked Lena. What Jeffrey viewed as youthful ignorance that could be trained away, Sarah interpreted as a willful arrogance that would become a lifelong affliction. The problem with Sarah Linton was that she had never made a stupid mistake. Her high school years had not been riddled with drunken parties. In college, she had never woken up beside a frat boy in a hookah shell necklace whose name she couldn't recall. She had always known what she wanted to do with her life. She'd graduated from high school a year ahead of time. She had completed her undergrad in 3 years and still earned a double major. Then she'd graduated third in her class at Emory Medical School. Instead of taking a high-powered surgical fellowship in Atlanta, she had moved back to Grant County to serve as a pediatrician to the perpetually underfunded rural community. No wonder the entire county despised him. Sarah asked Lena, "She was found exactly like this, on her back?" Lena nodded. "I took pictures with my BlackBerry," Sarah said. "Download and print them out as soon as you're back at the station." Jeffrey nodded his agreement. Lena wasn't going to take orders from Sarah, which was a problem for another time. He told Sarah,
"The way she failed doesn't make sense."
He caught a flash in her eyes. She was too decent to disagree with him in front of his team. Jeffrey asked a leading question.
"Can you explain how she'd fall face up?"
Sarah looked back at the tree root sticking out of the ground. There was a deep furrow in the dirt that matched the dirty tip of the victim's left sneaker. "The etiologies of falls are well documented. They're the second greatest cause of unintentional injury behind auto accidents. So this is classified as a same level fall, or SLF. TBIs, traumatic brain injuries, appear in 25% of all SLFs. Roughly 30% of victims experience what's called an uncontrollable shift. So by degrees, you get a spiral fracture in the wrist or a hip fracture or a TBI. 10% of victims rotate 180. The center of gravity falls outside the supporting area of the trunk and feet. Damage is due to absorbed energy at the time of impact. So kinetic energy equals body mass and speed, which is related to the height of the fall. Jeffrey nodded thoughtfully, more for the expert goat roping than a fundamental understanding of what Sarah had said. He tried.
"Her left foot stopped. Her body kept moving forward. She spun around midair and slammed the back of her head into the rock."
"Possibly." Sarah knelt down by the body. She pressed open the girl's eyelids. Then she rested the back of her hand on the girl's forehead. This seemed odd to Jeffrey, the kind of old wives' tale that led mothers to think they could tell if their kids had a fever. Sarah was extremely scientific, sometimes to a fault. If she wanted to check for a fever, she used a thermometer. She asked Lena, "You were the first at the scene." Lena nodded. Sarah pressed her fingers to the side of the girl's neck. Her expression went from concern to shock to anger. Jeffrey was about to ask what was wrong when Sarah pressed her ear to the girl's chest. He heard a faint clicking noise. Jeffrey's first thought was that an insect or small animal was responsible. Then he realized the sound was coming from the victim's mouth. Click, click, click. The noise slowly tapered off into silence. She stopped breathing. Sarah jumped into action. Up on her knees, hands pressed against the victim's chest, fingers interlocked, elbows locked as she started compressions. Jeffrey felt panic stab into his brain.
"She's alive?"
"Call an ambulance," Sarah yelled. Her words jolted everyone into action.
"Shit."
Frank had his phone out.
"Shit, shit, shit."
Sarah told Lena, "Get the defibrillator." Lena scrambled under the yellow tape. Jeffrey dropped to his knees. He tilted back the girl's head. He looked into the mouth to make sure the airway was clear. He waited for Sarah's signal, took a breath, then exhaled into the girl's mouth. Most of the air came back into his own mouth. He checked the throat again, making sure nothing was lodged in the back. Sarah asked, "Is air getting through?"
"Not much."
Keep going.
Sarah resumed compressions, counting out each rapid push. He could hear her panting from the effort as she tried to manually pump blood through the girl's heart.
Ambulance is 8 minutes out, Frank said. I'll go down and flag it.
Sarah finished counting. 30. Jeffrey gave two more short breaths. It was like blowing through a straw. Air was going through, but not enough. Half an hour, Sarah said, starting another round of CPR.
Lena didn't think to check for a fucking pulse.
She wasn't expecting an answer, and he couldn't give one. Jeffrey waited for Sarah's count to hit 30, then leaned over and breathed out as hard as he could. Without warning, vomit spewed up into his mouth. The girl's head jerked forward, smashing into his face with a hard crack. Jeffrey reeled back. He saw stars. His nose throbbed. He blinked. There was blood in his eyes. Blood on his face. In his mouth. He tried to spit it out. Sarah started slapping the front of his pants. He didn't know what the hell she was doing until she pulled the Swiss Army knife out of his front pocket.
I can't clear her airway.
Sarah flicked open the blade, telling Jeffrey,
keep her head still.
Jeffrey shook off the dizziness. He braced his hands on either side of